Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife Cynthia's and my restaurant. And we've turned Elaine's into a literary hub in the D.C. area. I believe you're the 185th or 186th author I've interviewed since we've opened here.
Thanks.
And we offer free space for authors. So if you're an author or know an author, please let them know. We'd love to have them come here. These are my favorite part of the restaurant business. You can check out our literary salon at elainesliterarysalon.com. Hope Gibbs is our PR director. She's right over there. And please sign up for our newsletter, and you can be notified about once a month of what we have upcoming on the schedule. We do at least one a week. Sometimes we do up to three or four. So Irene Bennett learned early to create her own world. The eldest of six children in her native Louisiana, she escaped into libraries and books. When teachers lauded her middle school book reviews, Irene, the writer, was born. A lover of words and religion, this people person studied at Southeastern Louisiana University, Kentucky Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and the University of Florida. While serving numerous churches in eight states, she wrote curricula, taught Christian education, and contributed to newspapers, books, and magazines. She's also spent a decade teaching in Hong Kong, mainland China, and several Asian countries. Her fascination with China's ancient bells of Marquis Yi resulted in her prize-winning debut novel, The Battle of the Artisans. Irene lives here with her husband, Phil, near their daughter, Melissa, and son-in-law, Dave. She continues writing, speaking, and teaching while serving Western Presbyterian Church in D.C. as director of Young Families and Children. So please welcome her.
Thank you.
So it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Jeff.
Why don't we start off? There's so much about this I'm interested in. Let's just start off. Give us a little synopsis of the book. No spoilers.
This is the first fictional work about a national treasure of China, the bells of Marquis Yi. Scholars have been studying these bells, 2,500-year-old Bronze Age bells, since they were uncovered in 1978 in central China, just north of Wuhan, China. And I discovered them when I moved there completely by accident. And then I discovered one day one line in a book that said, "No one knows who made these bells nor why." And so I said, by that time I had studied enough that I knew a lot about China. And I said, "I do. I know why they were written, why they were made." And so this book is the story of a young boy who's quite artistic, and his macho father. They live in a village on Wuhan, on the Yangtze, what we know today as the Yangtze River, in a village built around a foundry. And so I had to learn all about foundries to write this story. But they make the bells of Marquis Yi, and if you want to know why, you have to read the book.
And people are clinking their cups as you're doing it. It sounds like little bells. It's kind of perfect.
Right.
So
only these bells do not are not round and do not have clappers.
Why don't you tell us about the bells? I looked at a picture of them. It's really interesting.
The bells are gigantic. They weigh about 10,000 pounds. They hang on three tiers. There's 65 bells hanging on three tiers on a rack that is 11 feet, an L-shaped rack, 11 feet one way and 25 feet the other way, and they're 9 meters tall. And they're played by five people with hammers, mallets rather, and sticks.
So what about that? Like when you saw these bells, I know what they're used for. What were they used for? You had the answer that no one else has. What was the purpose of these bells?
Well, the argument is whether they were ceremonial or used to rally troops in war. And I hold to the first theory that they were ceremonial.
Do you know when China first started using flags for communication? Like I know that, back in the Bronze Age, in that time, that was the way a lot of warfare was conducted, right? To get quick communications across long distances, that and sound.
Yes. And I really don't know when they started using flags, but I do know that they built kites and put small persons in them and flew them over the enemy for reconnaissance.
Okay, I got to hear more about that. how big were these kites? And you're saying this is Bronze Age people had the ability to fly?
Well, they did. fly kites. Yes, with small people. Small people.
So like a human being on a kite flying. Mm-hmm. I've never heard that before. That would be the first human flight, right? But I've never heard it mentioned.
That's the story. It's a Chinese story.
No, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because it, like, even like, you know, there's stories about like ancient cultures in Central America that they believe had the power of flight a very, very long time ago. There's in ancient Egypt, there's a sculpture that looks exactly like an airplane. And when they downloaded it into a computer, it's aerodynamically correct, you know? So, I mean, it's certainly possible. So this is a Chinese myth that they were flying people in kites, but it could be real.
It could be. I really didn't read much about that. I just have a young boy in a story who wants to get away from a father who's all of a sudden has become unbearable. And so he wants to go be, he's small, so he wants to go be a spy in a kite.
I mean, that's fantastic, right? I'm thinking there's so much of fantasy now, like, you know, about dragons and having like kite flyers like that. That's a fantastic premise for this.
Yeah.
I love it. So when you first heard about these bells, and you're like, oh, I think I know what those were for, how does that translate into inspiration to write your debut novel?
Well, actually, my own personal interest is music. Music has been a part of my life from birth. I come from a musical family, and I accidentally saw this book entitled The Suspension of Music, and I thought, what the heck is The Suspension of Music? And I opened the book, and it was a UCLA doctoral dissertation translated to a book for the ordinary reader. And it was about a tomb filled with musical instruments, 125. And I thought, that's crazy. I love archaeology. I've always read archaeological stuff, and I never heard of a tomb filled with instruments. So that got my interest. And then I discovered that half of them were the bells. And I thought about the history of the moment. And 2,500 years ago in China, it was not a nation. It was more like feudal England and Europe. It was strong men who took over an area, and they called themselves kings and fought each other. And they said, this is my state, but it was not, delineated by any authority. National authority. And there were battles. I was reading about battles. And when I read one where the guys tied torches to elephant tails and opened the gates of the city and sent them out against the enemy, I thought, boys would love this. And so that was my first inspiration. I'll write a story for boys and include the battle. Because there were other fascinating things about the battle, too.
You've got all the cool stuff, right? Right, this sort of out of fantasy, but it's real. Right?
Yeah, it's real. That's really history, yeah.
So when you're writing history like that, like how much do you allow yourself like to diverge from the facts because you're writing a novel, right? It is a fantasy in a way. So how you're allowed to lie as a novelist, right? We do that for a living. So where do you draw that line?
That was very difficult for me because I had written professionally all of my life, but I'd never written a novel. And because I'm a detective by nature, I was researching constantly. This was just so fascinating. And of course, every sentence has to be researched to create a world that I don't know. And I got bogged down in the research and the story. Because the story couldn't finish because I kept researching, you know. I would go, oh, wait, he put on a shirt and a jacket. What kind of shirt? Cloth did they have 2,500 years ago in China? You know, so it was that kind of thing. And finally, one day, I learned about something that we don't even have on the, I don't think it's even on the internet anymore, but it was write a novel in a month. And all it was you promise that you're going to upload every day the words you wrote and finish the story. So I learned this little trick. I'm writing the story, and I don't know what clothes he's going to put on. And so I just write right in the middle of the sentence, I need to learn what kind of cloth they had in China. And then I just kept going. And so I did all the research stuff. That's what I did to it. And I uploaded that as my real words. and I finished the story.
It was a National Novel Writing Month. Was
that the NaNoWriMo? Yes, that's what I was using.
Yeah, no, so many. I mean, I think there's like a million books or something that have been written because of that. But you're really smart. That technique is very common amongst writers who are writing, because if you stop every time, right, and you go down these rabbit holes, you can sort of disappear into them.
Well, yeah, you'll never get your story told. So I tell all budding writers now who ask me about it, write your story and then go do the research.
Yeah, that's very smart, because a lot of people don't do that.
And also because I'm told only about 10% of what you learn in your research actually shows up in your book.
If it's good. a lot because it's so interesting, right? A lot of people do these info dumps just because they're fascinated. And it is fascinating, but they say if it doesn't drive character or story, you got to cut it.
Right. I can talk about these bells all day.
Well, you know, so I'm curious about the bells. So you think they were ceremonial. And so how were bells like in ancient China? How were they used ceremonially? Just not talking about these specific bells, but was there like a legacy of this?
Oh, yes. These bells are made at the end of the Bronze Age, this set of bells. But the legacy of chime bells is centuries old before that. And so archaeologists have unearthed bells much older. But this bell set is unique because it was intact. The tomb had never been robbed. This tomb flooded shortly after it was sealed. And so nobody ever found it or ever opened it, which was another fascinating thing about it. So chime bells have been a part of Chinese history for thousands of years before this bell set.
And so what would the theory be of having like a 10,000 pound bell? Like if it's for ceremonial, like to me, that just seems like it's for distance or is it, does it make it like more significant as a ceremonial bell if it's louder or bigger? Or could that be an indication it was also used for some kind of distance signaling?
Well, I think because it's 65 bells, it would be difficult to move a 10,000 pound instrument, a bell set like that. So for me, that was illogical for war. You could use it one time for war, but then how many times are you going to move it? You know, armies move and battles are in different places. So it made no sense to me. But for ceremonial purposes, then it's in one place, you know, in the residence or the palace of the king, whatever he calls it. And can be used for festivals, for weddings, for any special event that the king thought warranted music. And music was quite important at this time. My story is set 50 years after Confucius dies, but of course he had very precise opinions about music and thought music related to the health of the society. So. And that's reflected in my story, too.
So I wrote a book in 46 BC Egypt, right, in that time period. And it's the farther back you go, the harder it is to find materials. What resources did you use to research this?
I'm so glad you asked that question. When I first started, I discovered using the Internet that people talking about China used two words. They said classical China and they said ancient China. And they mixed the terms up. And so I had to distinguish that for myself, because most of the time when they're saying classical China, they're really talking about anything since 200 BC. If they say ancient China, it's before 200 BC. And that line is drawn, as you would expect, by written documents, the sources that are available. And there are very few available before 200 BC. For example, in the tomb that was in the 5th century BC, there were 15,000 bamboo slips with writing on them. And they are an early version of Chinese writing, which required scholars to translate, of course. But my favorite thing about resources for this book was, while I was writing it, a scholar, and I've forgotten where, one of the Ivy League schools, a scholar published a book about what do we really know about Confucius. And the book was only documentation. So they did not follow any of the myths about Confucius. And so when I read that book, there was a story, an early story of Confucius's about a father and a son. And there is, it's one of those stories like we have in American literature where all the scholars argue about what was the real first version and what did it mean. And so I went with the very first understanding by scholars of that Confucian story, and that is really the theme of my book.
So I'm curious about the distinction between like something that's written documents versus like an oral tradition, right? Because it's almost like assuming the oral tradition or the myth that came out of repeating something over and over again is fabricated compared to like something written. Maybe that isn't. So like where do they draw the line for that? Were they just looking at like bamboo documents, right, to decide what was true and what wasn't?
Well, the author doing the book about Confucius was only using written material. But the distinction between historical documents that are written and oral tradition is a very important one. When people tell stories, they tell human beings have always told stories the same way. You tell the main kernel of the story, but you tell it your way. And so that's why stories are never the same twice. And in oral tradition, the storyteller, everyone knew in the days of oral tradition that that's what was happening. The storyteller was an esteemed person in the social group, and everyone knew that that storyteller was going to tell a story from their ancestors, but that he or she was going to adapt it to today. And so I even did that with my story. I was deep into Chinese culture. I lived there for 10 years, and my goal when I went there was to understand Chinese people from their perspective. I didn't want to put my Western ideas on them. So when I started writing the book, I had the same desire. I wanted to create a culture that would feel Chinese. And I even asked a 9-year-old boy to read the first 3 chapters of my book before I ever showed it to anybody else. And his mom called me. I said, just ask him to read this over the weekend. She said, he doesn't read. And then she called me on Monday and she said, Irene, I have to tell you that Jonathan said, where's the rest of the story? So I knew I had a story. And then when I finished it, I gave it to a friend of mine who grew up in Wuhan, China. And he read the story and he said to me, how did you know so much about my family and my village? So I knew I had nailed the culture. But there was a theme. And I want to tell you about that because Stephen King says, everyone knows who Stephen King is, the horror king. He writes a story from some situation that he sees, hears, or it occurs to him. He just starts with a situation and says, where will this take me? And then he puts the story in a drawer and he doesn't look at it for 2 or 3 months. And then he says, I take it out and I ask myself, let's see what I wrote. And what he means is, what theme emerged in this story as I wrote it? And then he revises according to the theme. And I did that with my story. When I found that Confucian story about a father and a son, I realized that was my theme. It was in my story, and I went back and made sure it was in my story.
So I'm curious, you know, when you say like how the oral tradition changes, it's more of a feature of oral storytelling to make it contemporary for people so they can relate to it. So when you're taking out like your Western lens that you're looking at this Chinese culture, which is a common technique in anthropology, right? You have to look at what they were thinking, what they valued, et cetera. Yeah, right. How does that change when now you're writing for a book that you want to also appeal to a Western audience? Like, are there any concessions that you make to like somebody coming with like a different epistemology in the West?
Absolutely. Actually, I have a friend who's a professor of communications at the Hong Kong Baptist University, and she read my book And she said about one passage, Irene, that would never happen in Chinese culture. No, 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 no kid would ever do that. And I said, I know. I had him do that for the Western readers. I literally went back and made sure that there were some things about my story that a Western reader would connect with. And the same thing is, a writer uses contemporary language sometimes for the same reason. You want the reader to connect with the story. So that language might not have been in that culture at that time, but you put it in so that the reader will feel comfortable with something familiar.
So your framework is what the culture was, and then you're adapting for a new audience.
Right.
So when, because there's so few written documents from that time period, you mentioned that there were these bamboo documents or script right inside the tomb. By the way, how did they survive if the tomb was underwater? I'm curious about that.
Well, I'm no scientist, but I had to do a lot of reading like that, and I can't answer your question scientifically. But I was fascinated because the rack that the bells are on is lacquered. And so the scientists had to ask themselves, what do we do about wood, lacquered wood? They didn't know about the bamboo slips when they were asking the question, what do we do about lacquered wood? And so I read a paper by a Cornell professor about that, and I can't tell you a thing it said. They just they figured out what to do so that when it dried, it would not disintegrate. And so the scientist figured it out, the archaeologist. I really don't know the answer to that question.
So you can tell a lot about a culture by not just what they record, but what they don't record, right? So did you read all the translations from these? Was that part of your research? You said they were translated by scholars.
Oh, the bamboo slips?
Yes.
Well, those slips were, I didn't read them, but I know what they are about. They told the story of the funeral of Marquis Yi. So they're about the funeral. That's all they're about. Who came, who brought gifts. And the tomb had 15,000 artifacts in it, which mostly were gifts.
So other than like the lacquer, were there other things in this tomb? This is always fascinating when you find something that's intact like that. Were there other things that you discovered when you were researching that changed our view of like the level of technology or what they were doing in China at that time?
Well, a boy answer comes to mind. I was fascinated that there were chariots in this tomb for war. And on the chariots, I can't remember what they call them, but have you seen those 18-wheeler trucks that have those really fierce-looking hubcap thingies?
With like the
it look like
something
knives.
Sharp sticking out?
Yeah, they've got short. Yeah. Well, you know, that's a thing here nowadays. Well, 2,500 years ago in China, for the chariots, they put knife-type things on the center of the wheel, and that was, you know, to catch a horse or catch a person going by when they were running with the chariots. So, you know, that was the first thing that came to mind when you said something different from technologically from now.
And were those blades bronze?
Yes. So I have the foundry makes those blades too. Oh, very cool. In the book. Yeah.
So I'm curious, this was your debut fiction. Yeah. What did it feel like when you first started? Like, so many people think they have a book in them, right? But it's very difficult to do. Was there, when you were writing this, and despite like, you know, your love of China and the history and everything, did you find it, was there anything surprising about how difficult it was to write a book?
I learned on the way to do, there were lots of things I didn't know. So I learned as I went. For example, whenever I worked with a story arc, you generally know what a story arc is. There came a day whenever I just looked at an event in the book and I said, I don't know whether this event is good for this age reader. The protagonist is 13, so the book is aimed at older children or younger teens, although to my surprise, adults are reading it because of the history. But anyway, I thought, gee, I don't know whether I should put this or not. And then when I got to thinking about it, I decided to do it in a different way. And then I decided to put it in a different place in the storyline. So, you know, you just run into all kinds of questions when you're writing, and you solve them according to your schema.
Did you enjoy that problem solving? Did you enjoy the actual writing of the book?
I did. I love that. Yeah, I love telling stories, and I've never tried to write one, but I will put a shout out for writers should write in community. There is just the lone, depressed, drunk artist view is dumb. It's just dumb. It's not accurate. And there's pros and cons to writing in a group. But I was in a very vital writing group at the time, and we're still friends, and almost everybody in my group has published more than once. And but we were very, very much supportive community, and I learned a lot from just taking a chapter to critique group, you know, and having them react to it. So I'm really an advocate for writing groups.
Yeah, writing community is really important. But for those writers here who want to write alone and be drunk, we did win some awards for signature cocktails. So please take a look there.
So I gave him that. That's for you.
So besides your writing critique group, in the group, so I'm always interested, how did you find these people and how did you know when to take their advice?
Well, in Hong Kong, when we went to Hong Kong, my husband and I had this whole retirement plan. You know, we had this list of things to do, and Hong Kong was not on the list for retirement. And so when that happened, the surprise of Hong Kong, I just said to him, okay, I'm going to do one thing on my list, which is write fiction. And so I just looked at the South China Morning Post and saw an event one day, and I went to the event. And literally, I didn't talk to anybody at that event. I got on the train to go back to my flat, and I was sitting on a seat, and I saw three people hanging, you know, by the, whatever you call those things,
straps
on the train. And I thought, I think those folks were at that event. And so I just spoke to one of them, and they immediately said, we're in a critique group. Will you join us? And I did. And so that's how I got started. And then what was the other question?
Well, so what was the process in that critique group? Like, were you doing like a chapter at a time, or were you doing a whole work and then they were reading the whole thing and evaluating?
What we did was you had to present something every time we met, and you had to be below 3,000 words. So we said no other criteria. And so everybody read it before we got there. So you're talking about it immediately. No reading on the spot. And the number one rule of a critique group is, it's my story, not your story. Okay, so if somebody, and it always happens, somebody starts saying, well, why don't you have him do this? And why don't you have this happen? And how about if we go there? And you look at them and go, that's not my story. You write that one. So you pay attention to that. And for example, one thing that happened to me was I dreamed the first sentence of my book well into the story. And I had a number of people tell me that I was starting the story in the wrong place. And we can have that literary conversation. And I know the pros and cons about where my story starts and what's wrong with starting it there and all of that. I can tell you, you know, from a right, what's wrong with it. But I was committed to that beginning.
Why were you committed? Because that is the most common thing I see with new writers, is that they're usually about three chapters too early because they're trying to create the world in their heads. And then when they finally get to the story, it's later. Why were you committed to that? Was it because you had already written it? Was it like a adherence to like your original idea? Or was it a love of the words? Or what was it that made you stick with that format?
I did two things. It was important to me for the relationship between the son and the father to be set up first. Not the world, not anything. The first line sets up that relationship problem. And his real problem is 18 or 20 pages into the book. And so that's pretty normal. You don't have the real problem until you get just a little ways into the book. And so I wanted the culture of China to be obvious in my book. And Chinese culture, all humans are alike, but Chinese culture is different. Asian culture compared to Western culture, to be totally simplistic, is group-oriented versus individualism. That's totally simplistic, but it shows itself in huge ways in day-to-day life. And the respect that Asian people have for members of the community and for the importance of the community over what I want and what I do and say is really, really primary. And I just wanted that quieter cultural idea to permeate my book, and I hope it does. That's another feature of the book, is an emphasis on that community. And that was for me trying to be honest in presenting Chinese culture.
I mean, that's a fairly standard format, right? Sort of the hero's journey. You're doing the initial 10% or whatever in the real world, and then you're having this call to action that happens in the main conflict. So, I mean, that doesn't sound like you started too early.
Well, see, I tell editors I didn't start too early, yeah. But they were telling me I did.
And so then the last part of that question was, so then when you're getting this feedback from them, because they generally say for writing groups, right, tell the writer where it's not working for you, but don't tell them how to fix it, right? Because they usually know the first one. How did you know, if you had the majority of people telling you there was a problem in one area that you accepted it, or did you just go by your own instinct when you got the feedback?
I think whenever you have a repeated piece of feedback by more than one person, then they're probably right and you're probably wrong. So I usually listened. When more than one person said no to something, I said, okay, I'll change it.
So you talked about some of the themes. So there's the collectivism is like the society writ large. And then mm-hmm. you have the father-son dynamic. What was the purpose, or what is the purpose of the children's book? You tend to make points, right? What was the lesson that you were trying to teach with the father-son relationship?
That they understand each other and work together. So they had a common project. It's a complicated common project, but so they unite around a common project, and in the process get to know one another better because they're different. They're so different, but they're still both artists. A metal worker is an artisan. We call people who do crafts with their hands artisans, and that's why the book was titled Battle of the Artisans, because not only is it the father and the son in their relationship, they're also working together on this problem to produce these bells, and then there are all kinds of problems with that, and they are competing in a contest, so that's another battle of the artisans, so there's more than one battle in the book. And I've wandered and forgotten.
So about the father-son relationship, like, did you draw on anything in real life to have this dynamic between a father and a son and trying to find some kind of a mutual agreement or understanding?
maybe because, well, no, I never had a conflict like that, you know, of my own with an adult. But I think it's a common problem that most readers would recognize.
So how long did this book take you to write? When you first sat down, okay, I'm going to write this book now. You put pen to paper, whatever. How long to finish?
Oh, gosh. We were in China, about 7 years, because I felt totally out of my element. So my confidence was... I was always questioning myself, and I'd never published fiction, and so I just didn't have the nerve. In fact, when I wrote the first chapter and outlined or said what the rest of the book would be about, I actually was taking a creative writing course, and they gave me the option of writing a magazine article, which they assured me they would find a publisher for, or I could propose a book. So I proposed the book, and the course I was taking was with the Institute of Children's Literature in Connecticut, which has been around for decades and decades and decades. Their courses are accepted by universities for university credit. That you work with a working published author. So every lesson you send to the author and the author gives you feedback. Well, when I sent the book proposal, that author said, this book will sell. Here are a list of publishers. Send it here. I did not.
So did you work with that author in the writing?
She was my teacher for the course.
Okay.
But the last lesson was, you write an article or you write a book proposal. I sent the book proposal and she said, this will sell, send them.
Right. So that's actually a really important point, because you are not alone. I talked to number one New York Times bestsellers who have, you know, 20 million books in print, and they tell me the same thing. Every book they write, they're like, this is the one they'll learn I'm a fraud, right? This is there's always, so why is it, because you've written other things, why is it within fiction that it creates that trepidation? What is it about fiction that's different?
I suppose it's the lack of experience, because you're living in an imaginary world and you're creating all this imaginary stuff. Everything else I'd written was from my expertise and my experience. I didn't tell a story that I hadn't experienced, you know. But when you do fiction, you're just like, oh my gosh, is anybody going to think this makes sense, you know? So I was just very, very... I had no confidence at all. And with all the good feedback I got, I still had no confidence about it.
Don't feel bad about that. Very common. So when you finally got a publisher, the book's published, they send you your author copies. Tell us about that moment getting your books. I always love to hear this, because it's 7 years of writing, and now you've got your imagination in your hand as a tangible thing. What's that like?
I was thrilled beyond words. I cannot describe that feeling. But my second reaction was, oh no, I hate what they did with the cover.
Did you have any input on the cover?
Actually, I did, but there was some miscommunication. I was dealing with a Chinese publisher. The actual physical publishing part was a Chinese company, you know, but I was a British publisher. Actually published my book in Hong Kong.
How did you find the publisher, and what was that process? Like, you have so many publishing avenues, right? Hybrid and traditional and self-publishing. And then within each of those, there's a spectrum of different types of publishing. So how did you find Proverse?
Well, this is another one of those not believing in myself stories. I actually, early on, when I first started writing on the story, I went to a publishing... Or there's an organization in Hong Kong called Women in Publishing Hong Kong. So no matter what your job is, you belong to that. So I had joined that organization. So I was at a cocktail party. I didn't know anybody. And this couple started talking to me. And of course, you know, he immediately looked at me and said, what are you writing? And I told him, and he said, send us the manuscript. And of course I didn't. Said, that's very interesting. It's just what we're interested in. Send us a manuscript. And I didn't do it.
So how did you get to them eventually?
Actually, I have a friend in England who was in that critique group at the time when we were in Hong Kong. And after I got back to the United States, she just pestered me all of the time. Would you please send that manuscript to somebody? And I had gotten rejections here from American publishers because it's such a niche story, and I assume, well, they told me all kinds of things, but she kept saying that there's a British publisher in Hong Kong who has a contest every year, and this story is perfect for it. Send it. And I think the second year we were here, she was telling me, and it just annoyed me so that I just hit send. I didn't even reread it. You know, I would have changed something if I had reread it. I didn't even reread it. I just sent it, and I won the prize.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. That's a big deal.
And so they published the publishing. It was a cash prize and publishing. So
So you said you went out to other publishers here before that. Did you try to go through an agent first? Did you try to get an agent to go to the Big Five, or were you going directly to like independent publishers?
I did not try to get an agent first. Since I knew that this was a Chinese story, I went to publishers that were doing Chinese stories, and mine wasn't what they were looking for their list at the moment.
To what extent do publishers in China or in Hong Kong have pressure from the government? Is there any content like evaluation that happens from the government, or are they completely free to publish whatever they want?
This was done completely freely, I credit in here, for example, the Chinese director of the museum in China that houses everything from this tomb. My publisher did not want me to ask him for an advance publication statement. So that tells you.
So, I mean, there's no review, essentially, no government review?
No, and the book is currently being translated in the Chinese into traditional Chinese. And my publisher has a publisher in China who will, I'm sure, use software, but will translate it to simplified Chinese, which is what they read in mainland China, and so that the book can then be presented at the Beijing Book Fair next year.
Do you speak the language well enough to be able to read through it and see if they got it right? Because like
no.
It can change in translation quite a bit.
Translation is an extremely complicated science and art, mm-hmm. I am aware. And so some of my heroes in the world are those people who do simultaneous translation. I think they're geniuses. I don't know how they do that. But for writing, no, I will have no idea whether it's correct or not.
So how do they make the book available? Like, what's their distribution? It's from Hong Kong, so they have a partner in the U.S., or it's just going through, like, Amazon, KDP, or I'm curious, like, how, starting with a foreign publisher, a lot of times, like, a HarperCollins imprint will then just use, you know, an imprint that they have in the U.S. What's the process for this, for getting it out to this market?
Okay, well, this particular publisher is a boutique publisher. They're not one of the big publishers. They're British. And so they're using bookstores in Hong Kong and bookstores in England. And the oldest bookstore in England, I can't remember the name of, if anybody remembers, my book is with them. And then they're using all the online stuff. So this book is already available as an audiobook. And and then it will be in Chinese.
Did they consult you or give you choices on the narrator? Because that's always interesting.
Yes, and I will, this is a heads up. The narrator for this book is a British musician, so he reads with a British accent. And until he had done several chapters before, I listened to it, and he does not say marquee. That'll tell you right off that it's not an American narrator. He says marquees.
So the book comes out. You mentioned you had that 9-year-old that you use as an early beta reader. What kind of feedback have you had from like children, or do you get feedback from children? I don't write children's fiction, so I'm curious, like how do you know they're the end user, right? Are you getting it from parents, or how do you know how it's resonating with the children?
Parents are usually the most often the ones. If you go to schools, the first school I went to in Hong Kong, to make a presentation, I had 167 and 8-year-olds in the audience. And that was a wonderful experience. I was terrified. I've never been more terrified in my life to speak. I've spoken to, you know, huge audiences, and I had never spoken to 7- and 8-year-olds. But they were Chinese. You have to understand that Chinese children do exactly what the teacher says. So there was no issue at all. And I started with giving them an interactive activity. And standing on the stage, I said to myself, oh my gosh, I don't know how to stop them. And I looked at the librarian and said, how do I stop them? And so she stood up and clapped her hands, and they all clapped in response, and they were looking at me again. Is that not amazing?
That is a cultural difference for
sure. It is. But I wanted to tell you the feedback I got. I got two pieces of feedback from that experience that were totally unexpected. Most of these students were mainland students who were coming to Hong Kong for their education, 7 and 8 year olds. And the librarian asked me to come to the library, and the next class that came in, some students said, may we have an autograph? And I signed autographs for 2 hours. The students kept coming in wanting autographs. And I thought, well, this is kind of odd. They don't have a book. They're bringing me pieces of paper, you know. So I tried to write something pertinent to the book. But then at the end, the principal came in and talked to the librarian and then came over to talk to me. And he said, I am apologizing for missing your presentation. The students in the stairwells and the hallways and the teachers are all so excited to have a book that is Chinese history and culture. They are so excited. And so she had a waiting list already before I left the room for the story, because there are not enough stories about their culture.
How does that feel when you see how it's affecting the reader?
I felt totally verified that my desire to write about their culture was being met, being fulfilled.
So we're going to go to questions in just a minute. I just got to ask you some process questions, because we have a lot of our writers who are watching us. What did you write this in? Word or Scrivener or with a pen and paper?
Oh, I believe in the pencil and paper. That's my first love. But I learned the value of the computer. And so I use Microsoft Word.
Did you try to write every day? You said it took 7 years. So I imagine it was fits and starts.
No, I was teaching and roaming all over Asia, teaching and doing all kinds of things. Educationally in Asia. So it was bits and starts. I would put it in a drawer and not work on it for a month or two and then go back to it.
Yeah, so when you take those long breaks, it's out of your subconscious, right? I'm sure it takes time to get back into the story and the characters' heads. Did you have any rituals, or did you do anything that helped you like access your creativity when you would sit down to write after, say, 2 months?
I always read the story, and I did the Stephen King thing. He wrote a book called On Writing, and one of the ideas that he has in there is you write until you can't think of the next thing, and the next day you look at what you wrote, and then you write the next thing. And so anytime I have to restart something, that's what I always do. I just go, I stop when I can't think of something to write. And then when I go back, I read it and I go, oh, I did think of something. So here we go.
Did you have to write in like the same place, or could you write anywhere?
I can write anywhere, but I prefer, I need the solitude to create. I need to be alone, and I need not to have interruptions to create.
Because you need solitude, do you listen to music, or you just need total silence? Sort of, you're kind of following the Stephen King model, right? In the basement with nobody around.
I was in a 700 square foot apartment, so I wrote in the same chair all of the time when I wasn't, you know, scraps of paper in my purse always have something written on them, but which happens anywhere. But, you know, the actual writing I did in the same chair. And I'm a music person. I absolutely love playing and singing, but listening, not so much. I don't mind some soothing music in the background or familiar music in the background, but I don't want, 1812 crashes.
So no bells.
No.
And then when you're editing, do you use editing software, or did you tell us about like the editing iterations and how you did that before it got to a publisher?
Oh, it's so funny. If you look in my computer, I have draft number one, draft number two, draft number three, you know.
So how many
I edited myself. I did not use anything other than Word for editing. I did not use any kind of other program.
So let me ask you, and I ask this one question to every author. This came out of your head, right? It's based on some real history, but the story itself is something you manufactured. Where does that come from? Where does story come from?
I think life is a continuing series of stories. Everything's a story. So whenever I read about the war and I thought a boy would be fascinated by this, and then I thought a tomb with 125 musical instruments would fascinate a boy, especially if there are chariots next to the instruments. You know, it just sort of all melded into the moment that I saw that sentence, no one knows. And I thought, well, I do, there was another story. There was an adult story about one of the wars. And I put the adult story and the child's problem together. And there it was.
I love that. All right, I'm going to come around. If you have a question, raise your hand. And I'll ask you to use the mic. Just hold it really close. And if you would just kind of summarize the question in a couple of words before you answer for the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let's start over here. Any questions over here? She has to answer. She's on a podcast. How about on this side? Any questions over here?
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Amy.
So I have a question. A few years ago, the author Aura Flame wrote a book called Yellow Face, a novel. And the story in the novel is a white author steals the story of her Chinese-American friend. And it's all about cultural appropriation. And then it opened up a whole discussion once the novel came out about cultural appropriation. So I was just wondering, being a white author, even though you immersed yourself in the culture of China, obviously I lived there, respect it deeply, have you gotten any pushback about being a white author telling a Chinese story?
Amy's question is about a white author writing about Chinese culture and telling a Chinese story. As I said earlier, my professor friend gave me direct pushback about it. I also had a relationship with my Chinese teacher. My Cantonese teacher became a friend and is still a friend, for the whole 10 years I studied the language while I was there. And I asked him cultural questions constantly. And I'll just entertain you with this one. He wanted to give me a Chinese name almost immediately. And of course it was something like Mei Lin. And I said, no, every American gets named Mei Lin. No, you won't. And I am not a beautiful lily. You will not call me that. And so then as we studied the language, I'm a feminist, have been since birth. And so I would say to him constantly, this is so patriarchal. I do not want to say it this way. And he said, this is the way we say it in Chinese. And I'm going, it is so patriarchal. Why don't you say it this way? So we constantly had that kind of conversation. So I was very, very aware of the cultural issues. But he was so wonderful in teaching me the culture along with the language that I would have people compliment me on things that I didn't said because I did them the Chinese way. But I had learned them from my teacher. But part of my lack of confidence about publishing the story was that I knew that this issue of same voice in the publishing industry is really, really a big thing. And we understand it ethically and morally, you know. Why should I be saying your story? But then the other side of it is, God made us creative creatures, and we are to create. And so imagination is a gift to every human being, and every human being can imagine in any culture, anytime, anywhere. So I opted for the last to give me the courage to do it.
Other questions over here?
Irene, can you tell them when you first heard the bells?
Oh, my husband is wanting me to tell you when I first heard the bells. I As part of our research, we went to Wuhan, where the Hubei province has a museum for this tomb. Everything from this tomb is a wonderful museum in Wuhan, China. And when we got there, we found out that they had a concert every day. So we went to get tickets. And when we went into the ticket place for the concert, the lady said, "I'm sorry, we're not having a public concert today." And I was so disappointed because I had flown 4 hours to get to Wuhan from Hong Kong. And we went about our way. And in a little while, I mean, it was like something in the movies. 6 huge black SUVs came flying into the middle of this museum area. And they slammed to a stop, and guys in black suits got out and opened the doors, and all of these important-looking people went in the concert hall. And then the little lady in the ticket office saw us on the sidewalk, and she came over and said, "If you will do exactly what I say, I will let you hear this concert for these government officials." So in true spy fashion... She said, "Please do not take any photos. Don't do anything." And so she put us in the balcony, and all of those people were right down front, orchestra seats, you know. And it was a gorgeous concert of the bells with other Chinese instruments, the pipe that was Confucius's favorite one, and the zither, which you probably know about, beautiful women sitting at zithers playing them, and drums, of course. And so when the bells were playing by themselves, I recorded them surreptitiously. So I have a 2-minute recording of when they got to Beethoven's Ode to Joy. So they actually played some Western and Chinese music in that concert. And so when I heard Ode to Joy start, I turned on my phone, because I knew that my American friends would recognize that song, even on chime bells that don't sound as like a familiar instrument.
Other questions over here? Okay. So tell us what you're working on now.
Well, actually, I'm working on several things. One is a sequel. Well, not a sequel. One is another character out of this book who is featured. The main character is a contemporary Hong Kong girl who plays the piano. She time travels to this time period, and her best friend, of course, is a musician there. And so the bells figure in that story about how do we get back to Hong Kong. And then, so that story, also, I've been told by an agent that this will sell, please finish it, and I haven't finished it. It's 5,000 words, and I need 50, so I'm working on it. Closer to publication is children's devotional book, which is a result of my work at Western Presbyterian during the pandemic. The day the mayor closed down the city, our pastor called and said, on Friday, and said, "We have to go online Sunday. What can you do for worship from home?" And I said, "I'll send you a 5-minute video for kids." And so I don't know how many of those I've done since March 13th, 2020, but I've done a bunch. And I scripted every one of them. So I have a manuscript for everyone. I'm not a video for everyone because we've gone back to in-person worship. But I've made a book called I Wonder, and it means I question, I wonder. And it is 52 questions that children would ask and then my response to that. But it's an interactive conversation starter for parents to use with children.
I love it. So where do you want people to go to buy this book?
That one's not, well, it will be published.
Book.
Oh, this one right yes. here. Oh, right here. And now we have some right here on the table, and I will sign your copy. And this is available on Amazon, and then the audiobooks on all your favorite places you can find it.
So I ask everybody, if you just go on Amazon and rate her book, it takes like 15 seconds and it would be really helpful for her. So for discoverability. Excellent. And if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's, please rate us on Open Table or Google or wherever you rate restaurants. We'd appreciate it. And don't forget to sign up for our Elaine's Literary Salon. We've got a lot of authors coming and it's really a lot of fun. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much. Come back when your next book is out.
Thank you. I will.
Thanks.